ladies and gentlemen, it's time for another exciting episode of the Paperback Warrior Podcast. My name is Eric, and I'm your host for what is episode number 93. Imagine that. So we're slowly marching to that 100th show anniversary, which we have nothing planned, but hopefully something will come up. In the meantime, this podcast is an offshoot of our blog at paperbackwarrior.com. It's there that you can find hundreds of reviews and write-ups about vintage fiction from the 20th century. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Spreaker, and Pinterest, and glue yourself to the screen each weekday morning to see a brand new book review, either by myself or my co-host and esteemed colleague, Tom Simon. We have another awesome show planned for you today, and I'm really excited to present you the feature for this episode. I'm really jacked up for this. Today's feature is on an author named Clark Howard. Some of you may recognize that name from the 1970s and 1980s. Howard heavily contributed to Alfred Hitchcock Magazine and Ellery Queen. Plus, he wrote a bunch of great paperback originals for all the major publishers. But better than all of that, I've reviewed his books on the blog and right here on the show, so there's no reason why Clark Howard's name should be foreign to you. But today, we are putting him center stage as we delve into his life, his nonfiction work, his numerous awards, his full-length literary novels, and of course, where to obtain his books. Also, I'm going to tell you about a bet that I lost. I'm a little bit embarrassed about it, but I'm going to tell you about it. Tom has sent me an audio recording, and he's reviewing a 1959 paperback novel about an FBI agent chasing psychic spies. Woo! It's called A Brain Twister, and I think Tom's going to have a lot of fun with it, so I'm looking forward to all of this every dang second, and I hope you are too. So, first off, I want to tell you about a bet that went terribly wrong for me, and I'm really, really embarrassed about this, but I thought it was kind of a fun dad story, so I'm going to share it with you. And it actually happened a couple months ago. My 14-year-old daughter, Riley, and I made a $10 bet, and for the life of me, I can't remember what the bet was, but it isn't really that important for the story. So we make this bet, and she won, and now I owe her $10. So the day she won, I didn't have the $10 on me, and I rarely ever have cash in my pockets or laying around the house or, you know, even in my checking account for that matter. So I did an awful thing, and I bet money I didn't even have. She was a good sport about it, and she said I can just, you know, pay her the next day. So listen, for me to obtain paper money, it's like a 30-minute drive to the nearest ATM machine. We used to have an ATM that was a lot closer, but they ended up taking it out. So, and I'm sort of way out in a sort of a rural area of St. Augustine here in Florida. So with working at home and trying to read and review books for you guys, I just can't dedicate that kind of time to run down to the ATM machine to get money. So the week goes on and she's casually asking about the money each day. And I'm like, look, chick, I don't have it on me. I'm going to have to pay you later, you know, and I'm starting to feel like one of those characters in a 1950s crime noir with the gambling junkie who can't afford to pay the mob guy or something like that. So she starts to get more aggressive with her request. So after I went a whole weekend off from work with plenty of opportunity to drive to the ATM, she hits me up on Monday morning asking me if I had the $10. And kind of caught me off guard. So I said, no, I just, you know, simply forgot, which I did. And everybody knows I'm a homebody. I rarely leave the house except to do stuff with the family. 90% of my life is spent right here at home, sadly. So if I go out, it's for like a specific purpose, and then I just simply come home. So that week, I was expecting a package from Stark House Press containing an August release that the publisher's doing. The book is called Repeat Performance by an author named William O'Farrell. It's a Black Gat book reprint of this 1942 novel, and it comes out on August 23rd, if you want to check it out on Amazon. So I know that it's coming in the mail because my wife has that really cool X-ray postal app where you can look and see what mail is coming to you that day. I don't even know how that works, but she's got the app. So I'm really excited because I'm getting a book in the mail, and you know, everybody loves that, right? So Riley, at her wit's end about me squelching on this bet, she gets to the mailbox and she takes this package that is clearly addressed to me from Stark House Press. She brings it into my office while I'm hard at work, you know, trying to feed her and clothe her, and she shows the package to me. And I reach out my hand so she can give it to me, and guess what? She says, no, you're not getting this. I'm keeping it. So amused, I ask her if she's going to read it or something like that. Hopefully she'll say yes, but she says no. She's keeping the book. She says she's holding it as a ransom until I can produce the $10. And I'm kind of mad, but at the same time, I get where she's coming from. So I just laugh, and I say, I'll get your money tonight, knowing that I'm probably not. I tell her just to hand over the goods and, kind of mosey on out of my office. But she's standing her ground on this. She keeps telling me, she's keeping the book until I can produce the $10. And she's shaking me down. So nothing happens that night. I just go in her room the next day to get the book while she's at school. And she had the audacity to take this brown Stark House package, which is, kind of big and thick. Stark House has, fairly large books. She had the audacity to carry this package with her to school each day so I couldn't sneak into her room and get it. Because of COVID, they don't use lockers at school. So she's literally carrying around this Stark House book with her to all her classes. It's like she was on to me. Like she knew my game. So I had no other options but to get the $10 to retrieve what was rightfully mine. And I finally did. Sadly, the potential of me owning and reading a great book outweighed the fact that I owed my 14-year-old daughter a gambling debt. I'm embarrassed about that. So I got the money, I paid up, I got the book, and I promised her, and I'm going to promise you guys as well, that I will never, ever bet money that I don't have. So that's my little dad story, and I hope you enjoyed it. So many of you may remember that on the last episode of this podcast, I asked how you, Paperback Warrior podcast listeners, would feel about new book reviews being featured on the blog, and maybe here on the show. And I received an overwhelming amount of comments, messages, and emails stating yes. Yes, indeed. You do want us to cover new books every so often. And Tom and I are obliged to do that. It gives us, a little variance on what we read. And I think you'll enjoy the break between vintage paperback reviews to discover something new and exciting. Look, we love a good 1950s paperback as much as anybody. But there's some great stuff out there that we've been dying to read. Like anything about Paperback Warrior, our heart and soul will always be vintage fiction, but just don't be surprised to see new books being covered every now and again. So thanks to all the fans that responded to us. On behalf of Tom, we're really excited about this further evolution of the blog and show. So thank you. All right, so quickly, I always want to go right into this Clark Howard feature because it's going to be a little bit longer than the average feature that we do here. And I have so much to cover in terms of his stories and novels. So without further ado, here's that sweet music to get you in the mood. So way back on, I'm looking at this list. So way back on episode 24 of the show, Tom and I presented our favorite reads of 2019. Now, note, not books published in 2019, but books we read that year that we considered the best of the bunch. So on that episode, I reviewed Clark Howard's The Last Contract, and it made my top 10. Also, that was the very first Clark Howard novel that I had read, so needless to say, it was love at first sight. And since then, I've read more of his books and just find him to be a master storyteller. So nothing pleases me more than to talk about this author today and give you Paperback Warrior listeners some insight on Clark Howard. So let's get down to business. Clark Howard was born in 1932 in Ripley, Tennessee. Apparently, at some point, his family moved to the lower west side of Chicago. In 1944, Howard's parents either died or they simply abandoned him. I'm not sure which. So Howard becomes a ward of Cook County at age 12. Cook County, of course, is where Chicago's at. He begins staying in foster homes all over West Chicago. And at some point, Howard finds solace in a boxing gym called Midwest Athletic Club. And it's there that he mopped floors, swept, cleaned, and boxed a little bit as an amateur. By the time Howard reaches his teenage years, he becomes a juvenile delinquent and is sent to a reformatory. Now, sometime in that time frame, he's later sent back to Tennessee, where he lived with his maternal grandmother near Memphis, Tennessee. Okay, so it's now 1949, and Clark Howard is 17 years old. Where does a young guy go when he's bounced all over the place? You got it. He joins the military. So Clark Howard enlists in the Marine Corps, and man, he sees heavy, heavy action in the Korean War. In August and September of 1951, Howard served as a rocket launcher gunner in the bloody Battle of the Punch Bowl. This was part of a trio of substantial campaigns. The others were Heartbreak Ridge and Bloody Ridge. But in the North area, it was called the Punch Bowl. And Howard was one of only 8 survivors in his platoon. So heavy, heavy combat, heavy action. At the age of 20, he's discharged from the Marine Corps, and he's awarded the Korean Service Medal, and he also got 2 combat stars. Now, after his discharge from the Marines, Howard attended Northwest University in Chicago using the GI Bill. He was pursuing a degree in journalism, but Howard becomes discouraged with academics when one of his professors advises him that his writing was undisciplined and of no commercial value. Imagine that. That's terrible. So Howard drops out of school, but continues his dream of writing. He moves to Las Vegas, and he does publicity work for the International Boxing Club there, and he also wrote monthly columns for The Ring magazine. In regards to boxing, Howard claimed he followed no other sport in his life besides boxing, and he was able to meet some really, really good boxers. Think about the greats. He met Joe Louis, Rocky Graziano, Muhammad Ali, Sugar Ray Robinson. Clark Howard, through his whole life, just loved boxing. In 1954, Clark gets his fiction published. His short story, The Last Gunfight, was featured in the January 1956 issue of Stag magazine. In the 1950s, Howard had 5 short stories published in magazines like Crime and Justice, Manhunt, and Men magazine. Now, fast forward to the 1960s. The 1960s, he has 36 short stories published. 28 of those were for Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine. He had 24 short stories published in the 1970s. And again, most of those were in Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine or Mike Shane Mystery Magazine. Now, the 1980s were just as productive, as Howard became a regular contributor to Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. I mean, this guy was writing for the top magazines of that era. The best-selling publications. Now, before I talk about Clark's novels, I want to spend some time pointing out a few of his short stories. He had so many stories, and honestly, a lot of them won literary awards, or at least were nominated. Thankfully, his estate has partnered with Mysterious Press, Open Road Media, to offer 2 reprinted books collecting many of Howard's most well-known and award-winning short stories. The first collection is specifically called Challenge the Widowmaker and Other Stories of People in Peril. The second collection is called Crowded Lives and Other Stories of Desperation and Danger. Originally, these were released as rather unattractive hardcover editions way back in 2000 by a company called Five Star Publishing. I think they came out originally in paperback through another publisher, but these were really, really small printings. But now, thankfully, Mysterious Press has reprinted these books. They did this last year with modern covers, and they're in ebook format. So my first peek at the collections is Challenge the Widowmaker and Other Stories of People in Peril. Now, this book contains 12 short stories, including Ellery Queen Readers Award winners like The Dakar Run, Scalplock, Animals, and his 1980 Edgar Award winner, Horn Man. Now, most of the other stories were all nominated for various awards, including 2 Spur nominees in The Plateau and Custer's Ghost. I had a chance to read this book, and I wanted to share with you 3 capsule reviews of what I felt were the best stories in the book. The first one is called Horn Man. Now, this story was probably influenced by the author's fondness of jazz, a genre he discovered in Southern America in the 1940s. In the story's beginning, a former jazz star named Dix departs a Greyhound bus in New Orleans. After talking with an old friend, Dix explains that he's been in prison for 16 years after taking the fall for a woman named Madge. He asks his friend where Madge is now and that he really wants to see her. His friend isn't sure if Dix is really wanting to rekindle a relationship with a woman or murder. So it's an entrancing story as Dix is courted by both a jazz club owner and his friend to pick up an instrument again. So when a seasoned cop becomes involved, this 31-page story speeds to an interesting finale where the sins of the past come to light. It's a great story, and I can see why it won an award. The Plateau is another great story. The Plateau, again, was nominated for a Spur Award, and it's not a traditional Western. The story is set in a Western town in the future, and the last two living North American buffalo are owned by an old widowed man named Tank. The buffalo owner scratches out a meager living in this small Montana town with his daughter Delia. Now, the state has created this interesting lottery system where three winners will be allowed to hunt the last two remaining buffalo in North America. But when Tank realizes that one of the buffalo has died the night before the hunt, he begins to gain a fondness for the last remaining animal, and her name is Hannah, and she's this old female buffalo that has been in Tank's life for a long, long time. And he desperately needs the proceeds paid to him by the state, but Tank attempts to smuggle Hannah into the rugged Black Hills ahead of these three hunters. The ensuing chase is just an exhilarating and emotional read, as Tank's not only facing Hannah's extinction, and buffalo in general in North America, but also his own morality. He's getting older, his health is kind of declining, and you know, obviously he's in financial distress. So he's questioning, you know, his own existence at this point. It's just an exceptionally well-written story, and I really, really liked it. The third story in this collection that I really, really liked is called The Dakar Run. Dakar is D-A-K-A-R, The Dakar Run. And it's about a guy named Jack Sheffield. He's an aging race car driver with a gambling addiction. Now, due to some bad luck, he's racked up a large debt owed to a French criminal named Marcel. One evening, his estranged daughter, Chelsea, appears, and she advises Jack that she's dating a race car driver. She's requesting that Jack visit her boyfriend to review this supercar that he's created for this famous grueling race. Originally was known as the Paris-Dakar Rally, and it's a real race. Today it's called the Dakar Rally, and it's this off-road endurance race that welcomes really any driver of any kind of vehicle. The event transpires across multiple countries, including a long stretch of the Sahara Desert. Now, Jack has ran this race before and lost, but his experience could prove valuable to Chelsea and her boyfriend. So after Jack reviews the car, which is known as Max 1, he realizes it really has a good shot at winning this thing. The problem is that Marcel approaches Jack later and demands that he sabotage the car so that Marcel's large gamble on this other marquee driver could potentially pay off. If Max 1 wins, Sheffield's estranged daughter will benefit, and his relationship with her probably could improve drastically. But if Max 1 loses, Marcel will erase all of Jack's gambling debts from his books. I would really like to reveal to you the surprise twist in the story, but that's not going to be beneficial to, you know, potential readers. I don't want to ruin it for you. The story was simply awesome, and it really possessed some of the same elements of Howard's stuntman novel called The Last Great Death Stunt, which we're going to talk about later. Again, these three stories that I've just reviewed for you are in a collection called Challenge the Widowmaker and Other Stories of People in Peril. I bought it for $1.99 on Amazon, so I definitely recommend you getting it if you have an e-reader. Before we move on to Howard's full-length novels, I just wanted to circle back to his very first published story, which again was called The Last Gunfight, and it was published in January 1956 in Stag magazine. I really wanted to read it, you know, simply because it was Howard's first published story, and also because I've never read a Western by Clark Howard. He never wrote any Western novels, just short stories. So The Last Gunfight is about this quick-draw outlaw named Rimming. Now, Rimming has gained a reputation to be a fast-draw gunslinger, and he's known throughout the whole country. So when he rides into this little quiet town, and he sits down to have some food, the town's marshal comes by and orders Rimming to leave town. He explains, like, you know, look, it's a safe and peaceful little place. You're a notorious gunman. We really don't have any room for you. So he tells Rimming to get lost. He tells him that he needs to be gone by noon the next day. So after Rimming eats, he starts to reflect on his life and his current situation. This guy's been everywhere, and he's gained this, you know, reputation to be a deadly hand. And he's laughed at marshals, and, you know, he's laughed at the devil himself. But now, he's this old guy, he's tired, of fighting, he's tired of the opposition, and I think, honestly, he's just tired of breaking the law, and he just wants this whole thing to just be over. So he's got a choice to make. He can give himself up and face the hanging that he surely will get, or he can shoot this friendly marshal who hasn't, you know, arrested him, he just ordered him to leave town. He can shoot this marshal in a, you know, drawdown, and then just ride on to the next town to repeat this whole process all over again. But when he sends for the marshal to meet him in the street, he does something totally different. It's totally unexpected. I'm not going to ruin it for you, but just in case you end up, you know, finding this magazine or the story, if your curiosity is killing you, then you can email me at paperbackwarrior@yahoo.com, and I'll tell you the ending. Because this story wasn't reprinted in any of the collections. So again, your only shot of really reading this story is getting a copy of that January 1956 Stag magazine, which is pretty expensive. So normally I wouldn't offer to give you this ending of a story, but that's the reason why. Okay, so that brings us to Clark Howard's novels. He wrote 18 full-length novels, and I've had the opportunity to read a lot of them. So for my review this episode, and with Tom's permission, I'm going to go ahead and present my review for this episode right now. And it fits in really good at this portion of the feature because it's Clark Howard's first published novel. The title of the book is simply called The Arm. And it was published as a hardcover in 1967 by a company called Sherborne Press. But thankfully, it saw a much broader publication when it was released as a paperback by Fawcett Gold Medal in 1970, and it now, thankfully, exists as an ebook through Mysterious Press. I bought a copy of it, and I want to say it, again, was $1.99. So I purchased this ebook. I'm glad I did. The Arm, which, again, was Clark Howard's first published novel, it's a crime noir filled with really bad people, with really bad habits, and it's also got some really, really bad women in it. But I absolutely love this book. The book is about a guy named Cully. That's C-U-L-L-Y. He's this, you know, kind of like a hayseed plowboy from Evansville, Indiana. Now, Cully learns to shoot craps. That's betting on combinations and then rolling dice to get those combinations. It's probably the easiest game in a casino, and it typically has a bunch of people huddled over the table crying or laughing, or sometimes they're doing both if the liquor's cheap enough. So here's the thing. Coley's really good at shooting craps, so a guy named Hooker really takes to this guy. Hooker was a successful crap shooter, and now he's settled down and he's running this little bar in this little town. So Hooker tells Cully that he could go to Chicago and meet up with a colleague of Hooker's named Ferguson. So Hooker tells Cully, go to Chicago, go to the big city, find Ferguson. So the book starts out with Cully arriving in Chicago and just gawking at the big city and all of its wonders. Chicago's beautiful. I love it. He follows directions and he finds Ferguson, who surprisingly turns out to be a woman. I wasn't expecting that. So here's the deal. Mrs. Ferguson is informed daily of where all of the illegal crap shooting games are in Chicago. Further, she's paid enough to the cops so they just leave these games alone. It's a great place for someone like Cully to learn the lay of the land, but also, you know, not go to prison. So he needs Mrs. Ferguson. Now, Cully has free money from Mrs. Ferguson. She gives him money every afternoon, tells him where to go play, and the way the split is out of his winnings, he gets 20%. The Fergusons, her and her husband, keep 70%, and then 10% of the winnings go to Hooker, which was the referral source. So Cully, even though he, you know, he can win big, he's only getting 20%. So the book showcases Cully's rise from country boy, I guess, kind of, sort of, to suit-wearing, you know, city slicker. And as you can imagine, he starts winning a lot. And he starts to ascend from the smaller games to the big show of illegal gambling in Chicago. This is a club game where a lot of players are nearly as good as Cully. But at this level of, you know, the big show, this is where the book gets really, really interesting. Cully's chief rival at this level is a guy named Cole. Now, Cole has a beautiful stripper girlfriend named Lori that Cully immediately has an infatuation with. He can't stop thinking about her. He dreams of her. He's just infatuated with her. So Cully, as you can probably imagine, ends up tangled up with Lori, and they create this really dangerous love affair. While this makes up some of the narrative, Cully's employer, Mrs. Ferguson, has a really interesting husband, and he's also, you know, part of the gambling racket. Both of them, you know, own this racket. So you see, Mr. Ferguson was just as good as Cully back in the day, but now he's 100% blind. During a heated game back in the day, they were playing at like a garage, like a mechanic shop, and this poor sport was losing the game, losing money. He picks up a vat of battery acid and he throws it at Mr. Ferguson and permanently blinds him. The guy that did it has a heart tattoo on his inner sleeve, or inner forearm, I should say. Ferguson's paid like hundreds of thousands of dollars to detectives to track this guy down, but they never found him. So Cully, through playing at these smaller levels, ends up striking up a little bit of a friendship with a guy, and he catches the guy rolling up his sleeve one day, and he sees the heart tattoo on his inner wrist. So he knows that this guy is probably the same guy that blinded Ferguson. So he's got a decision to make. Does he report this guy to Ferguson, who's more than likely going to torture him and kill him, or should he just stay out of it and just live and let live? Cully's evolution from this poor country boy to this rich city slicker was just a real pleasure to read. And like any fish out of water story, there's the inevitable downfall. And when Howard reverses Cully's fortunes, it's done in a way that's really similar to the author's future literary works. We're talking about violent and unrestrained. So in many ways, I felt like this could be Howard's best work. It's the best novel that I've read by him of all the novels that I've read by Howard. I think this is the best one. And that's surprising considering it was his first full-length debut. But the book was adapted to film in 1987, and the film was called The Big Town, and it starred Matt Dillon, Tommy Lee Jones, and Diane Lane. And those were pretty big performers back in the day. Howard's next novels were A Movement Toward Eden in 1969, a war novel called The Doomsday Squad in 1970, and The Killings in 1973. After The Killings was a book that I've reviewed at paperbackwarrior.com and here on the show. It's called The Last Contract. It was published by Pinnacle in 1973, and it stars a Korean war vet named George Trevor that's worked for a shadowy organization called The System as a hitman. And after 17 years of, you know, assassinations and service to this organization, he just wants to retire, and he wants to live a peaceful life with his cat. But the system won't allow him to leave the industry unless he can produce one more assassination for them. But the details of the contract are rather unusual, and Trevor finds himself as a target. This premise has been used by authors a few times. Most recently, it looks like Stephen King's newest book, which is called Billy Summers, sort of has the same premise. The Last Contract is great. I really, really loved it. After The Last Contract, also written in 1973, was Siberia 10. It was also published by Pinnacle. It's another book that I've talked about on the show and reviewed on the blog. Siberia 10 is a fictional marine stockade in San Diego, California. It's here where prisoners are tormented by brutal officers, and there's racial tension and just a really bad place to be. The Marine Corps receives complaints from the prisoners, and they pull Marine Lieutenant Colonel Hannon out of a Vietnam jungle, and they ship him to this stockade to whip it into shape. It's one of those movies like Hoosiers, where the new coach comes in and turns the team around. The book's like that, but military-themed and much, much more violent and profane. I love this book, and I think I turned a few fans onto this novel, too, through the review on the blog, and they echoed my thoughts as well. Again, this book is Siberia 10, and it's fantastic. In 1975, Howard's novels Mark the Sparrow and Summit Kill were both published. I've got both of these in paperback, but I've never read them. In 1976, His novel, The Hunters, was published by Jove. I just recently read this, and I absolutely loved it. The book mostly takes place in the San Fernando Valley, and the hunters are four suburban neighbors with, you know, children and jobs and wives. However, each of them has their own sort of oddities that make them unique, and they all have a secret or bad thing that's currently plaguing their lives. These four individuals participate in two hunting journeys to Nevada each year. The group also use 30 caliber guns, and each one has some motivation for murder. And just prior to the departure of these four men to Nevada on their hunting trip, a Los Angeles police detective gets his head blown off by a 30 caliber rifle. So Howard's narrative explores the chemistry between these four hunters and their possible motivations for murdering this police guy, police detective, or even each other. As tensions rise, suspicions and motives become like shifting targets. There's a whole bunch of reasons for each of these hunters to kill a cop, but it's like, you know, trying to figure out what the connection is, and that's what makes The Hunters so good. Again, I love this book. Again, you can read my review on the blog. The book is called The Hunters. In 1977, The Last Great Death Stunt was published by Berkeley Medallion. This novel takes place in a not-too-distant future where sports have been replaced by death-defying stunts. And these stuntmen are kind of like, you know, Evel Knievel, and they do wild and outrageous things in cars and motorcycles and even on foot. But after years and years of stunts, and stunts killing people, the government has placed a ban on stunts. So on a specific date, at midnight, stunts will no longer be allowed. Anyone that does a stunt will be imprisoned. So a retired stuntman, who's considered the greatest of all time, is kind of lured back into the sport when his younger rival publicly states that he's going to do one more death-defying stunt before the lifetime ban occurs. He's planning on jumping off the Golden State Bridge. And folks, that's like 220 feet into the ocean. So these two stuntmen are facing off to find out which of them is actually going to perform the last great death stunt. Clark Howard had such a cool premise with his novel, and I'm surprised this book hasn't been adapted into a film. I think it would be a great one. It's like the battle of all time, and we always have this with, you know, sports figures and athletes. We always come up with who's the greatest of all time. It's like Michael Jordan or LeBron James, but adding in this kind of like Evel Knievel type of deadly stunt. It was such a fun book, and I have got a full review on the blog, of course. So his literature finishes out like this. Six Against the Rock, which is a prison breakout story from Alcatraz. It was published in 1977. The Wardens in 1979. Traces of Mercury, 1979. American Saturday, 1981. Brothers in Blood, 1983. Dirt Rich, 1986. Hard City, 1990. And there's, with Hard City, from what I can tell, this book is kind of like a semi-autobiography about a kid growing up in Chicago, going to war, boxing, and so forth. So it's really Clark Howard's way of explaining his own life to readers. And Hard City, 1990, again, is the name of the book. Love's Blood, 1993. City Blood, 1994. Now, Clark Howard was a member of the Mystery Writers of America, the Authors Guild, and the Writers Guild of America. He also was awarded a star on Palm Springs Walk of Stars for his literature and commitment to writing. Now, sadly, Clark Howard passed away in 2016, and he is interred at Desert Memorial Park in Cathedral City, California, with his wife, Judith. Okay, so all of the books I've talked about today are available affordably as ebooks. So whoever's running his estate, which is doing a really good job, has partnered with Mysterious Press to allow all of his novels to be available digitally. Prices vary from $1.99 to, you know, $8.99, depending on the week. I can't figure it out. You just kind of have to watch Amazon and see how these prices change from week to week. So again, these are ebooks. If you want paper only, you're just going to have to rely on the used market. If the physical rights are still available to, you know, make paper copies of these books, if the physical rights are still available, Starkhouse, Cutting Edge, Armchair Fiction, if you're listening, you've got some real opportunity here, hopefully, to publish these books. All right, now, I've got a recording that Tom sent me that I want to play for you now, and then I'll be right back to wrap things up. So here we go with Tom's review this week.
Hello, Eric, and hello, Paperback Warrior listeners. This is Tom with a dispatch from the field. Today, I want to tell you about a three-book series from 1959 that stretched into the early 1960s. The series doesn't really have a name. It should be the Ken Malone series, since he's the hero's name. But I've seen it marketed as the Psi, that's P-S-I, Power series. And I guess that's good enough for me. It's packaged as a science fiction series of books, since it deals with an FBI special agent chasing psychic spies. But what they really are is comedic espionage mysteries. Now, the author of this series is listed as Mark Phillips, but that's a pseudonym for the two real writers who collaborated on this three-book series. The real authors are Randall Garrett, who died in 1987, and Lawrence Jennifer, who died in 2002. The series originally came out, it was serialized in Science Fiction Digest magazines, and then they were retitled for paperback releases with no indication that the books were part of a series. If you find the paperbacks in a used bookstore, they're going to be in the science fiction section with no indication whatsoever that they are part of a series. I think Pyramid Books really did these guys dirty by not packaging these books more thoughtfully. Anyway, the three books in the series are, number one is Brain Twister, which was originally titled in the magazines That Sweet Little Old Lady, and that was from 1959. The second book is called The Impossibles, which was originally titled Out Like a Light from 1960. And the third book in the series and the final installment is Supermind, originally titled Occasion to Disaster, also from 1960. I think the serialization may have stretched into 1961 on that one. The good news, however, is that the series is available today on Kindle under the author's real names. They've been reprinted a lot, so you shouldn't have any trouble finding them if you are a Kindle person. I should also say that this is a series that should really be read in order, or at the very least, you should read book number one, Brain Twister, first, because there's characters introduced in Brain Twister who also appear in The Impossibles and Supermind. So I ended up reading 1959's Brain Twister, again, originally titled That Sweet Little Old Lady. The novel was nominated for a Hugo Award at the time. So Brain Twister takes place in the distant future of 1971, where we join our hero, FBI Special Agent Kenneth Malone, nursing a hangover when he's interrupted by his boss summoning him to save America from a dire threat. Now, see, Malone is a 26-year-old FBI special agent. He'd been an agent for about 3 years at this point. And in that time, that 3 years, he'd cracked some pretty big cases, and he's regarded as the director's secret weapon to combat this current threat that the nation is facing. Now, see, Malone learns that the U.S. government has been conducting research involving telepathy and has developed a machine to detect telepathic activity and mind reading. I think you should think of it as like a smoke detector for psychic energies. The problem is that this machine doesn't pinpoint who the psychic is or where he or she is located. All the machine does is identify that a particular individual's mind is being read. While experimenting with this new machine on a secret installation in Nevada, scientists discover that someone is invading the brains of other scientists who are working on a different highly classified project involving space travel. So the military base where they're doing all this research has been penetrated apparently by a telepathic spy. And the FBI needs Agent Malone to ferret out this spy neutralize him before the US government secrets fall into the wrong hands. So what we have here is a pretty cool setup for a science fiction espionage mystery. The execution is going to be very familiar to fans of police procedural crime novels. Malone embarks on a perfectly logical investigation, utilizing FBI manpower to shag leads that bring him closer and closer to the truth. I don't want to give too much away because it was an interesting twist in the novel, but he ends up enlisting the help of a very unlikely ally in completing his mission, which ended up causing the book to veer into some pretty wacky places. There are some genuinely funny scenes and way too many overly silly ones. At times, it reminded me of the Donald Westlake madcap crime capers that he wrote under his own name, much more so than a hard-boiled or violent novel of the future. The solution of the mystery in the end, as far as who the psychic spy is, really owed more to Sherlock Holmes-style deduction than any kind of psychic intervention. Overall, I thought this old paperback was really a lot of fun to read, and I want to read the second installment. I definitely recommend it. Now, on the Paperback Warrior blog, you can read my full review of this first installment, and there's a link to Amazon where all three books have been bundled together for like $3. Again, the book is Brain Twister by Mark Phillips. Now, I haven't read the other two books in the series yet, but I can tell you that The Impossibles, which is book two, deals with FBI agent Ken Malone, dealing with cars that begin to drive themselves and thieves who can disappear at will and apparently walk through walls. My read from looking at the back of the book is that it's some kind of telekinesis is at work here, and I'm sure Agent Malone can get to the bottom of it. The third and final book in the series has Malone investigating bad psychics who are able to disrupt the correct operation of computers by generating some kind of mental static. The back of the book also alludes to Malone being teleported to some kind of parallel universe. So that may be a more hard science fiction type book. Anyway, as long as you are looking for a light and humorous series with some cool and creative ideas, you're probably going to enjoy these books quite a bit. Yeah, I know I did. Anyway, so this is Tom from Paperback Warrior signing off. Eric, hope all is well with you, and we will hopefully see you guys later. Be cool.
Okay, so thanks for that, Tom. And thank you, listeners, for joining me on this episode of the Paperback Warrior podcast. Be sure to check out the blog for hundreds of reviews, and hopefully I'll be back in a couple weeks to do another episode for you. In the meantime, be kind, stay safe, and goodbye for now.